Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we get the story behind wars and politics, and we have details for adults, but it's still pretty simple. Let's get into it. Today's guest is very special. I'm very excited to have him. It's the Archduke of Austria and ambassador to the Holy See, Edward Habsburg. Yes, those Habsburgs. He is the great-great-great-grandson of Emperor Franz Joseph I of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the author of today's book, Building a Wholesome Family in a Broken World. Ambassador Habsburg, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So in your book, you talk about how families are kind of their own mini-societies, which you can kind of relate to a royal family or a regular family. And I wanted to ask, you know, we don't often have royalty or nobility kind of coming out to us, helping us with life lessons or teaching us things. What went into getting this book down into a book, all of these things?
Well, the basic background is my very, very positive experience with having a family. And with having six wonderful children, a wonderful, wonderful wife, and now getting into the grandchildren sector. And I mean, we're up to 30 years of marriage, and it's the greatest experience of my life. And I love my wife, I honestly, far more than when we got engaged or married. It's possible, I believe. And then I look around, and I see that in society, the thing most suffering and the most fragile thing seems to be relationship, marriage, dating, and all of that. And I thought to myself, perhaps the being a Habsburg helps you sometimes to have a little overview of things, to be sticking out of normal society. And so I thought, why don't I write a book about it? And I did. It's a mixture of my own experiences. Of course, Catholic thought, the Habsburgs are Catholic. I'm a Catholic. And Habsburg experiences from the centuries. And I think it's a breezy read. It's not a big doorstopper of a book. It's supposed to be something like a little starter kit for someone who wants to get married and start a family.
I love that. I definitely would agree with that. And I actually listened to the audiobook. That's how I read it. And I thought it was really nice. It was folded
And
stuff. So yeah. Yeah, it was very nice. It was like doing the dishes, like folding the laundry, and I was just like, it was really, really nice. So, the Habsburgs are traditionally Catholic, and you've had a personal connection, obviously, to the Catholic Church since you were very young, and that was very particular. Can you just talk a little bit about how that is a particular part of how Catholicism plays into Habsburg marriages traditionally?
Well, most of the Habsburgs that hang around today, there are several hundred, are still Catholic, and my family was Catholic since the 14th century, at least the 13th century, and always Catholic, with ups and downs, but always Catholic. And marriage was always an integral part of our family history. Now, I am myself, and my siblings are themselves, and but you always are a bit where you come from. It's just, it shapes your DNA. And so getting married and having a family and having that a priority was very normal from the beginning. It was also normal to be Catholic, and those two things combine really well together. If you read my book, you will see that I see faith as a very important keystone. Mm-hmm. Of a good marriage. And that, I mean, I have to say that whenever I was in the dating world and trying to figure out whether somebody would be right for me, I immediately gave points off if that woman was not Catholic or not a person of faith. I think it doesn't even have to be Catholic at all costs. But it's important that you marry someone who shares the Christian faith. If you don't have that in common, honestly, men and women are so different. We have different wounds, different biographies, different histories, different desires, different. All of that is different. If you have faith in common, you have the greatest thing in common. If you don't have that in common, it's far more work to make it work.
I agree with that. I find it shocking anytime I hear about people that are close to marriage, like they've gotten engaged and they haven't really had that discussion about how would we raise our children or, you know, what are the world viewpoints that we share deeply beyond just, you know, a couple surface things. I find it shocking when people don't share their faith.
Yes. I think one reason for this is that most people don't go into the whole marriage situation with a plan. And most people are of the opinion that you should tumble from one relationship into the next. And then at some point, you just get stuck and decide to get married. And that's how most people live this. And if you have that kind of relation, then you will never have that conversation beforehand, because you always have a back door. You can always back out. And I'm sad for people who don't have a chance to start this whole thing the right way. And that's why I wrote the book.
And, you know, right before we started the interview, I was mentioning how even if you're not Catholic or religious, there are still things in here, in this book, that are for you, that can help you with that foundation of how to get into a marriage and how to have it loving and lasting, and even the relationship to have with your children. And we're going to kind of get into that a little bit. So if you're listening to this and you're like, I'm not religious, there's still stuff in here for you that's really, really great. I feel that in the dating world today, there are a lot of people who have, there's this population decline worldwide, and there's this kind of thing of people having access to money, having access to potential partners and places to go, but choosing to kind of stay indoors, not date, connect virtually. Do you think that there's sort of this demoralization in society that might play a role in that, when people aren't dating and having babies as much?
I think that most people never experience what the wonderful marriage with many children is, because you don't experience it at home. Many people come from broken relationships, single raising moms, or they have maximum one or two siblings. So they never experienced family in the fullest. Add to that, that we are slaves to the machine, that we are glued to the screen the entire day, and that our technological masters behind the screen want us single and buying. And in order to have a single and buying and unhappy, because if you're unhappy, you buy. Every impulse from the net is stay alone, do your thing. It's about you. You count. You're the most important human being in the universe. Don't care about the others and never attach yourself to someone. This is the message that comes from the screen. And many people have a problem with that, fighting that. And if you never experienced, look, I have six children. And all of these six children now tell me they want to have large families, because the experience of growing up in a numerous family was the greatest thing in their lives, and they want to have the same thing. If you never experienced that, if in movies, in TV series, you never experience a marriage, with many children, you never see that. Yeah. It never occurs to you that life could be different. And that's why, again, some people might just, I totally agree with you. There are people out there who don't have a Christian faith, but just to slow down and take a good look at the kind of relationship life you're leading and compare it to this slightly outlandish thing that I write here in my book. Here is the cover behind me. The slightly outlandish claims that I make, take a look at them and say, wait a minute, there may be something in there. Perhaps the way I'm doing it is not really leading to long-lasting happiness, because you might have short-lasting happiness, you might have very exciting relationships, but what you have to think about is the next 70 years. And I tell you, I'm married since 30 years. I find my wife exciting, fun, and beautiful. That's possible. That's possible. And you want that?
Yeah, I love that. And so, you know, with your, it's funny you bring up TV shows. There's, I don't know if you've ever watched Blue Bloods with Tom Selleck.
Oh, dear.
It's like these cops and lawyers. And I love that show. And there's something. So they have this huge Catholic family. And there's this yes. kind of thing where in all the episodes, they all sit down Sunday dinners and they all talk. And
yes.
I never
yes.
grew up with that. And I watch it and I go, oh, like it hurts. I want that so bad. And there's something
wow.
that draws you in about that. And you can see that in your book, too. It just there's something when you talk about your large family and your children and interactions, it just it draws you in so bad. I think it's a human need. So.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely not yes. just religious. There's something spiritual. There's something just human that you're drawn to this kind of advice.
I mean, if you subtract the entire religious level and just say, if you grow up in a family with many siblings, a certain set of things will happen to you. First of all, you will learn that you're not the center of the universe. That is a very shocking thing, but for many people, you have this experience later in life. If you're in a large family, it's clear from the beginning that you're not the center of the universe. It's clear from the beginning that you have to engage in society, that you have to play your part to help the weaker siblings, to look after them when your parents are exhausted and overwhelmed, that you have to share, that you have to share the computer, that you have to share the phone, that you're not entitled to having the latest sneakers or the latest iPhone. All of that comes automatically. I mean, children are not happy about this. Even children in a large family would rather have the latest iPhone and not sharing.
Sure.
But by living that, you raise a group of people that will engage positively in society, that will build a better society tomorrow. That is all automatic results of living in a large family. And if you don't do that, and you're alone, you have to learn all these things the hard way later on.
Yeah, much harder, much harder. And one of the things that the Habsburgs are known for is having lots and lots and lots of children. And
yes.
do you think that there's this, they also, of course, as we discussed, were Catholic. And so there's this kind of different view that maybe other royal houses didn't necessarily have that were outside of a strong religious marriage, where do you think that the Catholicism was part of having this huge family, or was that just something royals were expected to do?
I think I rather agree that it was just a Catholic thing. Nowadays, the Catholic Church has become very cautious and in encouraging families to have lots of children. But it used to be normal. If you're Catholic, you have a large family. And that was, of course, before the 60s, and suddenly there were means to keep families down and all of that. But if you look, I think several things come together. Catholic faith comes with chastity, comes with confession, comes with being very much more aware of all these things. And one example that I give in my book is Ferdinand the First. He was the brother of Emperor Charles the Fifth, the famous one, in whose reign the sun never set. We're talking 16th century. And his brother was in Austria, and he was also, after him, the next Holy Roman Emperor. Ferdinand the First was a very devout man. He was a chaste man. He never had love affairs. He never had lovers. He got married. He loved his wife, and it was probably the happiest marriage among all royals of that time, because they were both Catholic and they shared the same view of fidelity and chastity. And he was horrified and shocked by Henry VIII, who, just because he couldn't control his urges, gave a shocking example to his subjects, and in the end managed to break apart the English church from the Catholic church on the long run. So, yes, it's a very Habsburg thing to do. And from the first Habsburgs to the last, they always had lots of children. Nowadays, I mean, I've got some cousins who have not as many as I have, but we still have large families. So I think it definitely comes with the Catholic and with family tradition. And when I got married, thankfully, I found a wife who had the same values. And and I want to encourage all of the people who are listening to this and who are watching this talk is like, think about having a large family. If you're not sure whether that's something for you, at least give my book a read, give me a chance to lay it out for you. It's the greatest thing in the world. Jobs come and go, riches come and go, cars come and go, and that thing is something that nobody can take away from you. If I could give everything else I had in my life, including my current job, for having that family life again, I would give everything. So it's really worthwhile. But you have to go about it in the right way, and then you'll have a happy and long marriage.
Yeah, and I want to add to that too. It's funny, we're talking about Henry VIII, which is, I think, probably the far end of the spectrum of an example of a marriage. He's like the rock bottom of the antithesis to what you should look to in a marriage, for many reasons. Also, you know, the book isn't entirely about having children. If you're listening and you're like, I can't have children, or I can't have a lot of children, there's still so many other things in there. And I wanted to talk about how it's odd between Habsburg siblings. So again, they had so many siblings, so many opportunities for rivalries, and they just didn't. There's like one big example of the brothers' quarrel that happened. When was that? In like the 1600s. And that was between two Habsburg brothers. And like, other than that, there's not really, you have these hordes of children and they don't have these crazy fights like a lot of other royal households. Do you think that there were values that were instilled in them to kind of prevent constant warring and fighting? It's so strange.
There is a very nice quote by, I think it was Ferdinand the First or the Second, who said that one should thank God for daughters, because daughters unite kingdoms. And if you have too many sons, they will drag them apart and fight with each other. So the Habsburgs were very aware that this can happen. But after the 1600s, it was always one reign, one emperor. You had the primogeniture. The younger siblings knew that they were not going to be emperor or anything like it. They were sometimes the spare. So what happened quite often was, because children died a lot. If you look, for instance, at the children of Maria Theresia, she had 16 children. And out of those, there were quite a few boys and a lot of girls. And in the end, only two boys remained that got married. One of them died early and had no children. And in the end, it was just one son that carried the family on. And it was not the one that was planned to become emperor. Ferdinand II, the great champion of counter-reformation in the 30-year war, he wasn't at all planned to be emperor. He was just a minor Habsburg in Styria. And because of the things that happened, blah, 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 he climbed up the ladder. But he never made intrigues or wars against his brothers. So there was a strong education to Christian values, to humility, to knowing your place. That always, in my book, I have a chapter where I speak about that. It's a funny topic called the Habsburgs and homeschooling, because the Habsburgs over the centuries did most of their schooling at home in their castles. Mm-hmm. And we have the old CVs and see exactly what they learned, what time they got up. It was a very strong and very, very ordered education built along faith and prayer, virtues, values. They had to eat simple food, not to live luxurious, not what we imagine royals to be. They were raised to be good people who tried to carry the system and be good examples to their subjects. And I think that's one of the reasons why there were nearly never, there wasn't any time without tension. For instance, Emperor Francis II, who was first Grand Duke in Tuscany, then became emperor. He had like 8 brothers, and all of them were brilliant. And he was the least brilliant of all, but he was the first one. So they were constantly telling him how to do things, and he was incredibly irritated. All of his brothers were brilliant. He was the emperor. So there were tensions, but there were no rivalry in war.
I can imagine that You know, the Habsburgs are also known for really emphasizing service in the role, responsibility and service. And so I can imagine everything you're talking about, large families where you learn you're not the center of the universe. Maybe you have a responsibility, so the rest of the world thinks you're the center of the universe if you're the emperor. But I can imagine that those values were, they must have contributed to why these siblings didn't war as much as the other royal families that were just constantly fighting each other for the throne and usurping and all these things. It is really remarkable.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask, you brought up Maria Theresa. I wanted to ask, she had this, so she was the mother of Marie Antoinette, who's a Habsburg.
Yes.
And she, Marie Antoinette was sent to France to unite the kingdoms and marry the King of France. And there's this whole kind of thing with her mom, Maria Theresa, where her mother really heavily criticized her a lot, but she also gave, it was like this relationship where she also gave a lot of support, and it was kind of this balance. Do you think she's kind of a role model maybe for how you can do some of different styles of parenting?
Maria Theresa was quite a powerhouse. She was constantly writing to her children. She was, and she had 16, and they were, many of them were married all over Europe. So she was micromanaging their lives even when they were at another court. And I mean, partly this, you can explain that by European politics. You had to see that your child in another country doesn't spoil the relations between the countries. But partly it was simply her style to over micromanage her children. And as I write in my book too, the children dreaded her letters. Marie Antoinette, I read a letter where when she arrived in Paris, she got instruction from her mother how she should live at the court. And it began with, when you wake up, the first thing you do is you get out of your bed, you kneel on the floor, and you say the following prayers. And you can imagine this like for a 7-year-old child. But when you're married to the King of France, this is not something you like to hear. So I think many of her children slightly resented that, and she perhaps overdid it a bit. So I wouldn't take her as a prime example to how to deal with your children. Well, nowadays we have WhatsApp and something, so parents can also interact into the lives of their even married children. I have one married daughter, and I have a second one that is soon married, and we're in contact all the time. But it's not like in Marie Theresia's time. But Marie Antoinette is a very interesting example because she came with all the good education. I think she then got a bit lost in the life at the French court. If you read Stefan Zweig's biography of her, who said, I think it was Marie Antoinette, the life of a mediocre woman in a way. And then in the end, when she was in prison and prepared for death, you could see the great woman in her and also the great Catholic again. And she refound all of that in the last weeks of her life very strongly. And she had, if you read my first book, I think it's in the first book that I tell this extraordinary story of her death that most people don't really know. And if you watch the Ridley Scott's Napoleon movie, you get a very wrong idea of how Marie Antoinette died. Because she was a deeply devout woman. And like all devout Habsburgs, she wanted to go to confession before she died, which was very important as a Catholic. Yeah. You believe that you want to put everything in order between you and God before you die. But the revolutionaries didn't allow her that. And for her, that was an agony. It was an agony. And she suffered the last days and weeks of her prison because she couldn't go to confession. And then we have this really touching story. We got it from, there is a very, very interesting testimony of the time. It's called Charles-Henri Sanson. He was the executioner of Paris. He wrote an autobiography. You can find it online too. And he wrote about the French Revolution. He was from an old family of executioners. And he wrote about the French Revolution and all the people he brought to the guillotine and how he talked with them on the way to the execution and all that. And he has a short passage on how he accompanied Marie Antoinette to the execution. And she was, you know, with her hands tied behind her back on that little cart, rolling through the streets of Paris. And he said when she got on the cart, she was totally nervous and anxious. And she looked around the whole time and she looked at the houses. And he, and she said, what's wrong? And then she drove past one house. And then she was in total peace. Her entire face relaxed. She was in peace. She was friendly. When she walked up the stairs to the guillotine, she asked him pardon because she stepped on his foot. And then he cut her head off and she died. And she was astonished. She said, what has happened in that house? And after the revolution, he spoke with Catholics, underground Catholics, and they told him what had happened. Catholics had learned that she wanted to go to confession and didn't get the permission. So they smuggled in a Catholic bishop to Paris. Whoa. And if you were called as a priest or as a bishop, you were immediately executed. They smuggled him in and they told her through a messenger, when you're on your way to the guillotine, a bishop will be standing at the window and he will give you the absolution in extremis, which you can do in very dramatic circumstances. So she was looking for that man because everything depended on that. And when she saw him, she was in peace. That was her Catholic and her Habsburg upbringing that carried her in the last minutes before her death. So she's really more of an example and less of that Sofia Coppola movie, vain and luxurious.
That's beautiful. Oh, why weren't Catholics allowed during the revolution?
Because the revolution wanted to totally eradicate the Catholic faith. The revolution wanted to introduce a faith of reason. They had a temple of reason. They turned Notre Dame, you know, the church that was now restored and reopened. That church was turned into a temple of reason. And they introduced their kind of priests. But of course, they weren't faithful Catholic priests. So they absolutely forbid her to do that. And I like it. I think it's a good story to learn from history. And people mostly remember Marie Antoinette for apparently having said, let them eat cake, which she never did. This is a story that was told about another woman. It was told about another woman 80 years before her. But people just attached it to her. It's one of those legends that will never go away because it fits our prejudice against arrogant and aloof aristocrats. But she wasn't at all like that. So, that's one of my ancestors. No, not ancestors, but family members.
Family members. And if you're listening to this, Marie Antoinette did not say, let them eat cake. Just know that. And so I want to talk about love real quick. That's one of the topics you touch on in your book. And I don't want to give too much away. People really should read the book. But so we talk about how important love is. And it's funny, people might have this idea about the Habsburgs where they're like, married just purely for political reasons. But it was really, the Habsburgs were interesting in that they also emphasized love. And you have the famous example of Franz Ferdinand, who married for love. And the only way he got your great, great, great grandfather's approval was to exclude his children from succession. Can you tell us a little bit about Franz Ferdinand's dedication to his wife?
That's incredible. I mean, she nowadays, or even a few years later, she would absolutely have been good for him and all. But at that moment in Habsburg history, you were only allowed to marry a princess from a royal house. And she was a countess from Bohemia. And he fell in love with her. And he had to go to so many sufferings to get the emperor to accept that marriage. And as you said, you did your homework. He had to renounce for his children for the throne. When he went to events, his wife had to walk several feet behind him. She was sometimes seated somewhere else. It was horribly humiliating. It was simply the protocol of the empire. And you see, love is important, but it's always a question about, he wasn't just in love with her. He had a deep relationship of mutual interests, values, faith, all their life, and up to the last seconds of their life. If you look at the moment they were shot to death at Sarajevo, where they traveled together, and And he was shot at, she was shot at. And he turned to her and said, "You have to live for the children." That's what he said to her. And they held each other. They loved each other so much. And they were great friends with another great love couple at that time, which was Blessed Emperor Karl and his wife Zita. That was a deep love. Empress Zita tells that when he lay dying in 1922 in Madeira, and he died of a lung disease, where he suffered terribly. His last words to her before he lost consciousness was, "I love you unendingly." I mean, this is something. Yes, 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 exactly. So, I mean, I hope those are my last words to my wife too. But what I'm saying is, love is important, but love is not being in love, and love is not simply attraction. Love is far more. And in a marriage, love is decision every day decision. You say yes to the other person. If you have a headache, it's still the person you love. If you didn't have enough coffee, it's still the person you love. I write about that in my book too. It's a big thing. It's a huge thing. It's a wonderful thing. And it was also important for the Habsburg. It's true that in the 16th century, in the 15th century, in the 17th century, many Habsburgs were married off for political reasons, but the Catholic Church doesn't allow you to get married off without your consent. So in all of these cases, it was tried to make you to get to know the other person, to understand whom you're marrying. You had to say yes to that. And if you marry, and the Habsburgs always tried to marry you off to someone who had the same set of values, the same faith, the same ideas about marriage, that helps a lot. And for instance, in the famous 16th century and 17th century, where the Spanish Habsburgs and the Austrian Habsburgs intermarried a lot, and it was the sort of the time that we call now inbreeding and all of that. Out of those 50-60 marriages of those time, nearly all of them were incredibly happy for both parts, and
really,
they didn't have the choice to pick their future husband, because they shared values, they shared sense of humor, they shared culture, they shared faith. And that's the message from the Habsburgs, is try to make sure that all of these things apply if you tie the knot with somebody. Don't just go for feeling or attraction, but take out the checklist, try to figure out whether the other person shares these values. If you want to go for the long ride, which is a lifelong happy marriage.
I love that lesson. I've been with my husband for almost 20 years now at this point, so I definitely would agree with you. definitely. I know what you're talking about. So I wanted to ask real quick before I forget. There, you mentioned the Emperor Charles, or the Blessed Emperor Karl, and his wife Empress Zita. I actually have a rather large painting of Otto von Habsburg and the Empress Zita arriving on her coronation day, and she's like in the carriage, and I have this painting of that hanging on my walls. I love that picture.
Why don't you show me? Where is it? I can't believe that you have that.
It's downstairs. It's so funny. It's so funny.
Please send me a picture.
Okay, I definitely will. It's a beautiful... I loved this painting, and my husband got it for me for Christmas one year, because I was like, I need a copy of this painting. Like, it's beautiful. So, Otto was an incredible person, where maybe not a lot of people know this, but he actually fought. He was part of the resistance in Austria during World War II against the Nazis. He was an Austrian resistance leader, and he was sentenced to death by the Nazis because of this. And he eventually came to the U.S. He helped thousands of people escape the Nazis, and he came to the U.S. and helped us fight Hitler and the Nazis. This is Otto von Habsburg we're talking about. So, and that was Empress Zita and the Blessed Karl's son. And he was the last crown prince of Austria, of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I wanted to ask, so his mother was still alive while he was doing this. Did she have anything to say about all of his efforts in the war?
I am sure she encouraged him and his siblings, because he wasn't the only one. Many of his brothers were active in the war. never forget that when Hitler took Austria and annexed Austria, he called it Unternehmen Otto, the Otto Undertaking, which was because he was so angry that there was an heir to the throne of the Habsburgs that he called his attack on Austria Unternehmen Otto, because he was so angry about the existence of Otto, who stood, of course, for a multi-race, multi-language, multi-nation empire, and stood against everything that Hitler stood for. I am sure that they talked all of this through with Zita. And if you read my book, I speak about it a bit. But most of all, I have met Empress Zita when I was a young boy. I spoke to the same Zita that you have on your painting, and she told me about the day of the coronation that you have on your painting. She told me, and Otto that you see as a young boy on the painting, Otto took me to the balcony in the church where his father was crowned and showed me where he stood as a little boy peering down between the rails of the balcony to see his father being crowned in the church. So for me, all of this, what you have on your painting is very, very realistic because I spoke with the people who were there.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yes.
I'm sure I could talk to you about that for a very long time, but I don't have a lot of time here. That's incredible. Wow. I'm very, very jealous.
Yes.
That's so funny. Yeah, I'll send you a picture. It's this really, really large painting.
Please do.
So, please do. Yes. But before we go, I wanted to ask you if perhaps, you don't have to answer now, but perhaps in the future, you might consider coming on the show again to talk about Habsburg history and the Holy Roman Empire. Just because it seems like you do have a lot of knowledge about Habsburgs. Obviously, you are Habsburg, and you love talking about history.
I will gladly do so. But you will have to read my first book before we do that, because I spill all the beans on the Habsburgs in that book. And as you are interested in history, it'll be a fun read for you, and I'm sure it'll give us a lot to talk about. It's also a very slim volume. It came out 1 year before that one, or 2 years. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's a quick read, and then we can talk about, because what I do is I wrote a book where you have like 5 pages of history, and then I take the 7 central values family, and I run through them through the centuries. I always say, why did the Habsburgs incorporate that? Why did all the Habsburgs more or less do that? What carried them? So yeah, that's another conversation for another time.
Beautiful. Yeah. I'm going to go get that book as soon as we're done talking here. Okay. And then the other question I wanted to ask you is, can I read your screenplay? If not, that's fine, but I'm interested.
Which screenplay?
Okay, I didn't know you wrote multiple, but I know there's a zombie one that you wrote.
I was a scriptwriter for several years, and among them there is also one screen. It's an Austrian zombie movie. Yes, it was never produced, unfortunately. But I also wrote a screenplay on the last week of Empress Elizabeth around the Lake Geneva until she was killed. So I've got several screenplays that might interest you.
Goodness. Yes. I'm also a screenwriter and producer, and I do actually, before I got podcasting, that's, you know, where I still kind of live in that world. So I was like, oh my gosh, I have to read this. So yeah, just a thought. Okay. The book Building a Wholesome Family in a Broken World, you can get it on Amazon, Sophia Press, and many other places. And again, even if you're not Catholic, even if you're not religious, there are so many things in this book. Listen to the audiobook if you don't have time to read a physical book. The Archduke of Austria and Ambassador to the Holy See, Edward Habsburg, thank you again for joining us and answering all of these questions. I sincerely hope to have you back.
Thank you very much. It was a joy to talk to someone who's into history and who is also married since so many years.
All right. Well, thank you so much. See you soon. Bye.